Show.
Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to the Thursday edition, this Thursday edition of the Horn, 16th July 2009. I'm Bob, and I can't, I just sit sort of gobsmacked part of the time, wondering where the time goes. It seems that no sooner does one show end than it's time to start prepping for the next one. And that is kind of how it works around here. And last night's program ended, more or less, ended with that rodeo clown, that multimillionaire rodeo clown, Glenn Beck, screaming his fool head off. And it seems that we have got we've got a segue for that. It was Glenn Beck screaming his head off, and today it's language lessons with a junkie. Yes, yes, yes. English as a second language lessons as provided by street narcotics addict Flush Flemball. Oh, there's a ton of other stuff to get to, and we will. And if I don't, you'll bring it to my attention. Because that's how this works. That's why this is conversation radio. You play as important a part in this as anything that I do. Also, watched a little C-SPAN today. Sort of cruised away from the Sonia Sotomayor hearings to see what was going on in the rest of the Congress. And that was equally... oh, God, it was fun. And there's a valid explanation now for why Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is the way he is. He may not be so fond of the Klan once he found out that they were a bunch of dope smokers, but he has his own little predilections. And we'll get to that, too. I also hope, somewhere during the course of the broadcast, that we will get to, pursuant to an email exchange that I have had in the past few days, tell you a little something about something that's going to be going on available for you, Let's get that part out of the way quickly, the part where I can't speak the English language or else I'm going to make a hypocrite of myself. Now, you who contribute and support the program so generously, there's something going on that a member of the Horn family has done and created, and you'll be part of it, hopefully. And I hope that we will be talking with her later in the program pursuant to that aforementioned email exchange. Flush Flemball. You know, narcotics addiction does terrible things to the human mind. It just does. And when you are a narcotics addict who has an audience of purportedly millions of followers who are limited in their mental capacity in the first place, you have the possibility there for making some real trouble. In this particular instance, I am talking about, and this was link was called to my attention by our good friend David in Tennessee. You have we have an excerpt from Flush Flimball's program, kindly archived by the folks who do such amazingly good work at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org. This is from today's Flush Flimball program. Today's marching orders from the head of the Republican Party, the head of the Republican Party being, of course, a street narcotics addict. There's a lot of setup to this. The clip itself is about 3 minutes and 33 seconds long, 3 minutes and 30 seconds long, give or take the tag. And it's beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful. The ancient Greeks, whom I did spend some time studying, and I really couldn't help it because my sister, among others, when I was just a little tiny fella, my sister, as she was going through college at the time that I was a little guy, would share the stories of the Greek heroes and the myths of the Greek Greek pantheon with me. And I developed a fascination for it very early on, and went on and took classes in ancient history and Greek civ and Roman civ and stuff like that in college, when my classmates were taking useful things like accounting. But I was a liberal arts snob, and I took the Greek civ and the Roman civ and the Latin and the drama and the sociology and the anthropology, and that kind of explains why they're where they are and I am where I am. Because I don't think there are any accountants out there, at least not many, who have people tuning in, thousands of people tuning in, to hear compelling tales of balancing books and actuarial tables. But that's no slur, because they're doing a lot better for themselves probably than I am. But anyway, I took those classes. And because of that, I developed a love for some of the concepts that come from our forebears in ancient Greece. One of those concepts is a concept called hubris. And hubris was a concept more or less developed by the Greeks. It is often translated into English as tragic flaw. Hubris is a state of mind in which one cruises along so thoroughly assured of one's own greatness and grandness that one is utterly oblivious when one is about to take a big nosedive. Within the realm of the Greek concept of it, the ancient Greek concept of it, it's usually pretty profound when it goes down. You know, it's the one where Oedipus finds out that he actually killed his own father and's been banging away on his own mama and has to run off stage and gouge his own eyeballs out with his wife mama's the brooch and wander the world hated and blind for the rest of his days. That's how hubris works. But there's big hubris and little hubris. And this is just a little bit of delightful right-wing hubris today. Rush Limbaugh, the man who couldn't get through community college, the man who, as his alter ego Jeff Christie, may have actually been busted in Pittsburgh during his radio days for what was then termed pandering, which was, in other words, soliciting sexual relations with another member of his own gender. Flush Flimball, well, why, enough setup, because this is just, I'm ruining it. This is just too delightful not to get busy sharing right now. From his program today, proof that Flush Flimball apparently does not read the It Pays to Improve Your Word Power section of the Reader's Digest.
We also have some sound bites. This woman butchers the English language.
Talking about Sonia Sotomayor.
More than George Bush could ever try to if he ever got drunk again. We have samples, examples coming up. I want to play four sound bites.
Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Sonia Sotomayor butchers the English language more than George Bush could if he ever got drunk again. Drunk or sober, the man did a pretty monumental job butchering the English language for 8 years. We had a great deal of fun with it. There was the and the fella told me he wanted me to help him find somebody to pick onions, you know, pluck them. And of course, last night you heard Georgia's March Mango Madness monologue upon the United States trading nuclear technology to India in exchange for mangoes. Yeah, you heard that too. And, you know, I'm convinced that the human being and fish can coexist in peace or live together in peace. It's hard to put food on your family. Seldom is the question asked, is him or her, is our children learning? All of it. You lived through it. So did I. Enough already. But that's George Bush speaking English as his first language. In attempting to show his perspicacity in his second language of Spanish, it was to I believe Jose Maria Aznar, who was the former who is now the former fascist prime minister of Spain. It was to Aznar, maybe he was president, I don't know, but it was to Aznar that Bush turned and said, "You know the problem with the French. They don't have a word for entrepreneur." One of my favorites. Really, honest to goodness, one of my favorites. They don't have a word for entrepreneur. And Spanish speakers the world over winced every time he tried to speak Spanish. Hola, mi amigos! Yeah, so somehow the comparison doesn't work for me. We're talking about a woman in Sonia Sotomayor who worked diligently to become an adept with the English language, as opposed to George Bush, who just stumbled into the nearest cantina and said, tequila por favor, muchos gracias, amigo, mas tequila. Okay? So anyway, that's just that part.
It's for you here.
Four clips, he says.
Of Sonia Sotomayor from various times in her career. And show how she butchers the English language. It's, you know.
Imagine this is the part of Oedipus Rex where Oedipus thinks everything is hunky-dory. Okay? This is all the prideful, okay? This is all the big prideful boasting, you know, I'm a wonderful... Right. This is... Yeah, Rush is so smart. Yeah, remember, he tells his little knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing audience every day that he is broadcasting with half his brain tied behind his back. Or, with talent on loan from God. Margin call! That kind of thing. Your truth detector. America's number one journalist. That kind of crap. So... just enjoy this as he goes about criticizing Sonia Sotomayor. Just say to yourself, it's okay. It's okay. Because it's coming. It's coming.
Fine and dandy, we all butcher the English language, but were it not for I, were it not for me pointing it out, you wouldn't know about it.
Oh, this is going to be sweet. I've already heard this two or three times, and it gets better every time I hear him say that.
A Republican nominee doing this kind of thing, it'd be laughed about all over the media. It'd be talking about, oh, this guy's not smart enough, he's got to go. If it were George W. Bush, Here is the first example. This is from Oral Arguments, December 10, 2007, in the Ricci v. DeStefano. That's the firefighter case.
Yeah, and he can't even pronounce DeStefano? DeStefano? Can't do that, Rush? Of course, I heard certain cracker senators today in the last couple of days referring to the Ricci case. Yeah, that Ricci case. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
First seven who are going to be hired only because of the vacancies at that moment.
She meant to say vagaries, but she said vagrancies.
No, Rush. She meant to say vacancies. She corrected herself, you damn liar. I feel a little bit like my dad right now, you know, talking to a guy who isn't here. But see, the attempt here is to paint her as some sort of female Ricky Ricardo. Oh, Lucy, you got a lot of splaining to do. You know, oh, that's funny. He can't hardly talk the English. Back up there.
Well, that's the firefighter case.
The first seven who are going to be hired only because of the vacancies at that moment.
She meant to say vagaries.
No, damn it. She meant to say vacancies. And she did say vacancies. She didn't choose the wrong word. She misspoke. Okay? People have been trying to teach me to speak English well for years, and some of the little voices and dialects and so forth that I do on this program probably have my old theater speech coaches simply... They don't know why, but they're sitting at their dinner table, and at the same time, sometime, I'm, Marvelline, come here! And my old speech teachers are this sick shiver goes up their spine, as we say here in the hills, like somebody done walked across their grave. And they don't know why, and it's because of what I'm doing. There's mean to and didn't mean to. And then there's just tripped over your own tongue. And that's what that was.
But she said vagrancies. The first seven who, in fact, that whole clip, there's what we have here, we don't have it, but there's a clip. This audio from which we culled this is Sotomayor interrupting the lawyers for the firefighters. The lawyers for the firefighters are making a brilliant case as to why only qualified people should be hired. And she's...
Yeah, only qualified white people! Don't need none of them qualified, not quite white people, do we, Rush? No, not in your world, we don't.
She makes it very clear that she's not concerned about any of that. She's only concerned about race being accounted for by coming up with a test where minorities have...
Come on, Rush. Explain to your little mouth-breathing, knuckle-walking audience that the Circuit Court of Appeals was constrained by the federal law, which mandated that that be taken into account, and that Judge Sotomayor on the Circuit Court of Appeals did not have the jurisdiction or the jurisprudential ability to simply and arbitrarily change settled law. Explain that part, Flush. No, you won't, because you're a filthy little right-wing lying bastard.
A better chance to pass it. So, the first seven who are going to be hired only because of the vagrancies of the vacancies of them. She meant vagaries. Here's the next example.
No, there was not a damn word about vagaries. But anyway.
Under New York law, if you're being threatened with imminent death or very serious injury...
It is not imminent. It is imminent, with an I in front of it. Here's the next one.
...is educate themselves.
Oh, hold on just a minute. You mean it's get and not git, like your boy Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III says, Rush? Now, I know that there are, and I take umbrage at it because I am a Southern man myself, there are people in this country who believe that Southern folk don't speak English as such. And then, of course, there was the feeling of the English for English as it's spoken over here. I believe it was the late, great George Bernard Shaw who said, the English and the Americans, or the British and the Americans, are two kindred peoples separated by a common language. Yeah, that's pretty good, isn't it? Eminent versus he can't. Now, see, that's just cheating. That's dialect, not word choice. But that's okay, because Flush is your truth detector, and he's going to tell the knuckle walkers and the mouth breathers and the ditto monkeys just exactly how to speak the English.
Build up a story of knowledge about legal thinking.
It's a store of...
No, do you hear how short that clip is? Story of knowledge may actually be the correct words. If we're talking, for instance, about legal history, which is a fascinating topic, and it's all full of people whose names are K-O-C-H, but they're pronounced, or C-O-K-E, C-O-K-E, but it's pronounced Cook, or maybe it's C-O-O-K, but it's pronounced Coke. I can't remember, but it's fascinating. Or it was at the time, until I put it on a brain cell that I subsequently killed. But anyway, we talk about the stories of things. Sometimes we also talk about a storehouse or a store of knowledge, but at other times we do talk about stories. But you don't have enough context there in which to make any kind of judgment. You have nothing to rely on except the word of a street narcotic junkie. Can you imagine that? Conservative, so-called conservative America, takes its marching orders from a junkie. Whew, man! They are some kind of hard up for leadership, aren't they?
Knowledge. You build up. Now remember, I mean, we're told this woman, she worked hard, this woman is brilliant, this woman is just fabulous. These are... You don't find too many learned people making these kinds of vocabulary mistakes.
No, but sometimes you find braying asses make them rush, and we're just waiting. We're still waiting. Oh, this is going to be delightful.
Vagrancies for vagaries, eminent for imminent. A story of knowledge for store of knowledge. And here's the last one.
All questions of policy are within the providence of Congress first.
Province. It is province of Congress, not providence.
I'm not so sure. I've listened to this clip a lot of times. I'm not so sure she said providence.
A story of knowledge for store of knowledge. And here's the last one.
All questions of policy are within the providence of Congress first.
Providence.
Sounds to me like she says providence. Not providence, Rush. Providence. But you go ahead and tell us about providence, okay?
It is province of Congress, not providence. Providence is a city in Rhode Island. It's also, Providence is also a record of, say you're a wine collector and you have some old classics. And you want to sell them. You've got to be able to prove the providence. You have to...
Huh? No. Providence is comes from the same linguistic root as provide. And it... We speak sometimes about divine providence. But I've never heard it... What? Providence was a record label? A record? It's a record label? What? The Colonel Tom Parker cut some of Elvis's early wax on the Providence label? I thought it was Sun! Keep going, Rush. Keep going. This is too good.
Be able to prove that they're real. How you got them, where they've been, how they've been stored, that's the providence of something. The providence, the you know, questions of policy are the province, the right of Congress.
Oh, dear. And that, speaking within the previous metaphor, is the point where Rush Limbaugh has to rush screaming off stage and gouge his own, I don't know, cut his own tongue out with Jocasta's brooch, where Oedipus gouged his eyes out. Provenance? Okay, I've got a story. I've always got a story. I've told you that in a portion of my misspent youth, this would be particularly, I believe, the summer of 1983. I tried my hand at archaeology. And, you know, a lot of people think about archaeology and they immediately think about, you know, Indiana Jones or something on the Discovery Channel that involves imminently exploding volcanoes or, you know. But I tried my hand at archaeology, and I took my incredibly pale pink skin into the blistering heat of southwest Tennessee at a little place called Pinson. One of the best-kept archaeological secrets in America, Pinson is. And there's a complex of First Peoples mounds there that go back to the beginning of the current era, that go back literally 2,000 years. And I had the privilege of digging, and the days were such and so hot and so very humid, and the place where we were digging, the ground, the elevation was so low in itself that we had to get up at 5 o'clock, get our digging done, and we were done by noon. Because after noon, you simply couldn't breathe there. And it was everything that, it was all the minutiae of archaeology. It was getting up and getting to the site, and it was taking a rat tail file to your Marshalltown trowel and making it sharp enough to shave with and doing the same thing with your flat-ended shovel, because you were removing layers of dirt that were literally no thicker than a piece of notebook paper or copy paper. And taking all that dirt and running it through a screen and seeing what kinds of fascinating little things popped out of it. And seeing stains in the dirt and realizing that wasn't a root stain, that by God something had been there once. That it was a post hole to somebody's house. A house that was 2,000 years old. And Lord, did I get sunburned. I got sunburned. Woo! But it was one of the most, obviously I still remember it. It was this time. It was right now. It was right now, 26 years ago. And I worked with a crew of absolutely brilliant people, fascinating people, from all over. Because this site had been acquired by the state of Tennessee in a moment of really stunning and insightful forward thinking. Had it not been for the acts of the Tennessee legislature back then, it might well have McMansions on it now, because it's not very far from a Church of Christ university called Freed Hardeman. God, it could have some sort of fundamentalist dormitory on top of a mound now. Plow it over, boys! They didn't believe in Jesus nohow! And when you would pull some little tiny shard of pottery out of the earth, and you would handle it, and you would gently brush it with a toothbrush of soft bristles, and see the marks in the pottery made on the wheel, and know that you were handling something that had not been touched since little baby broke mama's best pot and it got thrown out the back window into the midden. That'll do something to you. It really, really will. But anyway, I was a student, and everyone I was working with were real archaeologists, and they were my teachers. And they taught me a lot of things. And one day, with a couple of beers in hand, we walked through the basement of the museum complex that had been built there. And little Timmy, little Susie, Uncle Bob is going to use a fun word, so leave the room in a minute. And apparently all kinds of Amerindian artifacts had made their way to that museum, some more recent than others. There were the so-called peace pipes, tribal gifts that had found their way into the museum. There were pottery, stone tools, fascinating things. And they would just pull them out and say, hey, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this. And I'm sitting there and I'm looking at these points and going, holy crap! Because they were just all over the place. And people who had collections of them, like, the old Uncle Silas dies and, you know, they donate his Arrowhead collection to the state of Tennessee, which he loved so dear. But there's no information there to tell you where Uncle Silas found the dadgum arrowheads. So from a data standpoint, you could tell what kind of point they were. But you had no means of knowing where they came from, how deep they came from in the earth, what sort of artifacts they were associated with in situ. And as such, they were functionally useless for academic or scholarly or scientific purposes. And it was probably about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a Friday. The sun was high in the sky, and the sky itself was so faint a blue as to be almost white from the glare of the sun in the southwest Tennessee, on the southwest Tennessee earth. And we had gone into the cool, air-conditioned museum, and we were looking at all these things, and I had an ice-cold bottle of some sort of beer with that condensation just dripping down it. And one of the scientists, who had one himself and was showing me all these fascinating things, it was like being shown some sort of archaeological holy of holies. At least it was for me. And I kept saying, but where did it come from? What can we, you know, what can we learn from this? What do we know about this? And finally, not frustrated, but in one of those what is now called teachable moments, the archaeologist put his hand on my shoulder and he said, son, no provenance, no goddamn data. You understand what I mean, son? No provenance, no goddamn data. This could be your Matchbox car collection for all the data it provides in what we're trying to figure out was going on here. No provenance, no goddamn data. And the word provenance, P-R-O-V-E-N-A-N-C-E, provenance, has entered my vocabulary at that point in time and has stayed there ever since. Later that evening, we would all be together on top of the second highest earthen mound in North America, second only to Monk's Mound in Cahokia, Illinois. And we would watch the moon rise. And if you tried really hard in the far distance, you could hear the songs of the people who built all those mounds. And you could know that you were seeing a rising moon that they too had seen. And you could sense a connection through time itself that you would have never thought possible. And a lot of that ground had been plowed by farmers in the past, and you had to go a couple of feet down before you got past the plow scars. The earth holds on to the stories of what has been done to it, even if it's something as prosaic as planting cotton or beans or tobacco. And you could see the plow scars in the earth a good 2 feet down. And so you had to go down that far before you got any provenance. No provenance, no goddamn data. But that's okay. That's okay. America's truth detector thinks the word is providence. And it's not like the distinction between vagrancies and vacancies. It's not like the difference, the pronunciational difference between eminent and imminent, or get and git. Unlike Glenn Beck, who simply opened his mouth and uttered a great barbaric yawp, the recognition of his failing, fading, disappearing world. Flush Flimball, flush, in fact, with the false impression that he has some knowledge of the language. He, who never even passed a sophomore-level English class and probably scraped through senior high school English by the skin of his teeth. Has embarrassed himself on a level stunning to contemplate.
All classics, and you want to sell them. You've got to be able to prove the providence. You have to be able to prove that they're real. How you got them, where they've been, how they've been stored, that's the providence of something. The providence, questions of policy are the province, the right.
But they are also the provenance. Provenance was a correctly chosen word. As opposed to providence, which, as Flush notes, is a city in Rhode Island. God is a God of irony, and these are little gifts, without a doubt. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And then just couple it all together. Couple it all together with the knowledge that in order to be able to speak to America as he speaks, in order to tell America that the English language doesn't mean what the English language means, you gotta pay that freak $40 million a year. Woof. This is the horn. Chime in. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. We'll take a little musical interlude, and we'll be back. No, not that one. I don't want that one. I hate it when I got a good bumper and it's all blasted. Confounded, frazzled, bled, stinging, muscle, Windows Media Player. Let's see if we can get this right. What do you say? I mean, just for fun. This was all, it was going so good. And then to get screwed by Microsoft. Astonishing. All right, let's try this again. Okay, this'll do. We'll be back. We're going to have to get over this. I'm Bob.
Can you tell me, friend, just exactly where I've been? Is that so much you ask? I'll pay you back no matter what the test.
The Allman Brothers are always a good substitution, and that one fit equally well. Welcome back. Not like you went anywhere, or like I did either, for that matter. But I guess we're supposed to say those sorts of things. At any rate, I wanted to, before we go on into the more of the meat of the program this evening, an update to a story that was at the top of prayer meeting last night. The testimony continues in the trial of Tony Alamo. He is charged, of course, with transporting underage females across state lines for purposes of sex, of having sex with them. 10 counts. If he's convicted on a couple of them, that should put him away for the rest of his natural-born life, which would be fine by me. Testimony continued in the trial. Our good buddy Marty sent this along and suggested I save it for next week's prayer meeting, but no, since we handled it on prayer meeting last night, this update is more than appropriate. You'll recall last night that I told you about a previous witness who took the stand in the case to testify that she was married off to Tony Alamo when she was 15 years old. And that she and she was taken around the country to be sexually available to him. And that she finally only realized what a demon she was married to when he described to her the act of sexually abusing an 8-year-old little girl who at the time was holding a teddy bear. Well, today, the former 8-year-old testified. The young woman, whose name is not here, I don't have in front of me, testified today that Tony Alamo married her when she was 8 years old. Wow. Remember when Jerry Falwell and the rest of the Southern Baptists and the rest of the... you see, that Muhammad, he's a pedophile because he married... I think the young woman's name was Aisha. He married a little girl and she's 9 years old. Remember that? Islam is a religion of child abusers. Right. Guess what? So is Christianity. Just say it. You know, organized religion. And then, just to be fair, there's that whole god-awful the sex scandal that's just broken all over, I think, Brooklyn, involving the Orthodox Jewish schools where rabbis were diddling the students. So, you know, for what's the book say? For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God? Yeah, come short indeed. I retract that. Thank you. The young woman is 18 years old now. She testified today that she started having sex, with Tony Alamo when she was in the third grade, when she was 9 years old and weighed only 98 pounds. That year, the honeymoon year, Tony Alamo had gotten himself one of them instant cameras, because you don't want to be sending your photos of your honeymoon, you know, the rather explicit photos of your honeymoon. You don't want to be sending them off to the Rite Aid to have them developed or nothing, because, you know, some people don't understand that kind of love. So he had him an instant camera, and he'd use his instant camera and take pictures of her and tell her she was a dirty whore. Glory, hallelujah, praise Jesus, you are a filthy whore. Mm-hmm. The woman, now 18, said she didn't understand the word at the time. but that Tony Alamo told her it was a good thing. Now, this is the trial of Tony Alamo. I want to know where the parents of this young woman are. I want to know why. Maybe they are, and it just isn't included in the AP story. But I want to know where the parents are, and I want to know why there isn't a 10-count indictment or a 2-count or a 1-count, some sort, anything. Well, no, you can't indict them because they was just following their First Amendment guaranteed rights to believe as they seen fit and pimp out their 8-year-old daughter. Praise Jesus. I can't think of enough lousy, stinking, rotten things. To happen to Tony Alamo. I really can't. But I'd like for some of those rotten things that take the form of something called justice, I'd like for some of those rotten things to happen to that child's parents too. Because you know what? I think you could ask survivors of sexual abuse, and they'll tell you that memory doesn't go away easily. Your daddy's dirty little whore, and you're good. That's hard to get out of your psyche. I don't know how you get over it. Maybe horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner has some better, can speak to that. I can't. And it's cases like this that make me understand why there is an element of our society that says, just take them out and shoot them, Bob. Take them out and hang them or shoot them or electrocute them or give them a dose of something. Or just kill them. They got a good killing coming to them. I remember that line in Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird, in which Scout, narrating, explains that her father, Atticus, had a real distaste for doing the criminal law and had had such and had vowed he would participate in it no more ever since the trial of so-and-so, who were being tried for murder and insisted on presenting the defense of the bastard had it coming to him. That's a sort of rough justice that's very prevalent in our society. Ours is a society with what I have called in the past, and hang on to, a punishment fetish. We like to round up the posse and ride out onto the plains and find the criminal and bring him back and give him a nice fair trial and hang him. But you wonder how many people there are out there calling for the stretching of the neck of Tony Alamo, because he is, after all, white, and he is, most importantly, a man of God. I don't know. But you know that he's already hollering that he's being prosecuted because of a conspiracy by the Vatican. Because, you know, old Benny's just sitting around there in the Sea of St. Peter saying, well, I think we have finally got our old nemesis, Herr Alamo.
in a spot from which he cannot extricate himself. This is very, very good. Yeah, it is.
Tony Alamo, by the way, is not his real name. Our buddy Juanita informs me that he was born in 1934 as Bernie Lazar Hoffman. He is described as a controversial American preacher, singer, entrepreneur. You know, the problem with the French is they don't have a word for entrepreneur. And evangelist. It is his personal theory that the Pope is the Antichrist. You know, you would think with every time the Pope drops dead, that would kind of put paid to that little piece of doggerel. Nope, must not have been this. It's going to be a Pope. One of them's the Antichrist. Probably whichever one they name. He was brought up. He was brought up Jewish. His parents are Romanian, were Romanian. He has a big, big, big part of the ministry was bringing Jews to Jesus. Yeah. And Lord God, it's just hard to stomach. Am I in the wrong? Because I still hang on to this notion that there's something wrong with capital punishment. Because even Tony, I don't want Tony Alamo's life to be foreshortened. Because, see, I do like that sense of justice that the ancient Greeks developed, whereby someone who had grossly offended society and the gods would wander the earth, subjected to ridicule everywhere he went, so that people might know his misdeeds. I like how that works. Little children could throw rocks at him. Yeah. Whew. Merciful God. So we're at the top of the hour. We'll take our top of the hour break. The Green News Report from our good friend Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen is on the way. As are your phone calls, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, 304-658-3333 is the toll number. And email rolls into bobkincaid@gmail.com. Light them up. Let's see what you think. And we've still got all the other stuff to do, too, especially the reason why... The real explanation for why Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is the way Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is. That's all on the way. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Thursday, July 16, 2009.
A free ride for mining companies? Swine flu surges again. Plus...
Do you support capping carbon emissions?
I do.
That was then, this is now. Sarah Palin gets right-wing religion on cap and trade.
All that and more straight ahead from Los Angeles. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this is your Green News Report. Green News headlines. Here's Desi Doyen.
Thank you. The Environmental Protection Agency has announced a plan to rewrite the rules governing hard rock mining. The change was required by a federal court judge ordering the EPA to close a loophole that allows mining companies to avoid cleaning up after themselves by declaring bankruptcy, leaving the expensive, toxic mess to taxpayers. The EPA will issue the new mandates requiring companies to set aside funds for cleanup by 2011. A Senate committee is also considering changes to existing law to require those hard rock mining companies to pay royalties for the first time in over 100 years.
Really?
According to the LA Times, private companies haven't paid royalties to taxpayers for taking resources in 137 years. We've missed an estimated $245 billion in royalties.
Really? Now, see, this is something I think the Republicans would be in favor of. They supported Sarah Palin, speaking of which, up in Alaska when she gave back money that came from the royalties from the oil companies up there, when she gave it back to the people. They thought that was a great thing. I'm sure the Republicans will now be in support of this proposal, correct?
Republicans are generally not in support of this proposal because they say it will cost mining companies more money.
What about the Democrats? Are they in support of this?
It depends on who the Democrat is.
Yeah, apparently it does.
The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee has recommended a repeal of mandatory royalty relief for offshore drilling. The Bush administration's 2005 energy bill specifically released oil and gas companies from paying any royalties to taxpayers on some types of offshore drilling. That was to encourage exploration.
So this is a case where they didn't have to pay royalties.
Right, even while those companies like ExxonMobil were pulling in record profits.
Is it just me, or are the Republicans here somewhat schizophrenic on this idea? I mean, they really did. They loved it when Sarah Palin was giving back money to the people that was coming from the oil companies on these royalties.
Now, these changes in royalty payments for use of public lands are only in committee and have not passed the broader Senate. So if you have an opinion on whether royalties should be paid for resources extracted from public lands, you should call your representatives in Congress now.
For
we have those links.
For our resources. Royalties
yes.
For our resources. That are given to the oil companies.
Yes.
Okay.
Swine flu is still raging down under and around the world. Nations in the southern hemisphere are grappling with a surge of infections that are straining hospital facilities in Australia, Chile, Argentina, and Brazil currently in their winter season. The virus is not slowing down in the northern hemisphere either, with a surge of infections reported this week in Britain. A new study indicates that the H1N1 swine flu virus is indeed different than seasonal flu in the way that it infects the body, but the researchers can't yet explain why. At a swine flu summit last week, the Obama administration warned Americans to prepare for a surge in the fall.
This was a panic when it first happened a few months back.
Yes, it was very disruptive in Mexico and other areas.
Well, yeah, but you know, we have the flu every year. Why is this any worse than any other flu? So we get swine flu again in the fall.
This strain is different. It infects the body differently. It goes about it differently. They're not sure why, but it is different.
And so it's more dangerous is the point.
That's what seems to be the case,
okay,
yes.
Okay, I'm scared.
Sarah Palin, the soon-to-be former governor of Alaska, created quite a stir this week with an op-ed in the Washington Post criticizing the carbon cap-and-trade system proposed by the Obama administration. Palin's op-ed is filled with too many right-wing talking points and outright falsehoods for us to go into here, but we do have a full debunking at our website, greennews.bradblog.com.
And she was not always against cap-and-trade. She did not always call it cap-and-tax.
That's correct. We should point out that Palin was for cap-and-trade before she was against it. Now, here she is in her own words while running for vice president last year.
John McCain proposed legislation calling for mandatory caps on global warming gases or CO2 emissions. Do you agree with that?
I support his position on that, absolutely. He's got a good cap-and-trade policy. I support all that we can do to reduce emissions and to clean up this planet.
Well, you certainly wouldn't know she was against it based on what she said back then and on the Palin-McCain website, according to Rachel Maddow last night.
John McCain and Sarah Palin have proposed a cap-and-trade system that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A climate cap-and-trade mechanism would set a limit on greenhouse gas emissions. A cap-and-trade system harnesses human ingenuity. Do you notice she didn't used to call it a cap-and-tax program like she does now, back when it was part of her platform as a candidate for vice president of the United States?
Right you are, Rachel. She certainly didn't.
As Senator John Kerry lays out at the Huffington Post, she neglects to even mention the whole reason for cap-and-trade legislation, the imperative to transition to a clean energy economy to avoid the worst-case scenarios of global warming and its effects on food, water, and energy supplies. And Palin is ignoring her own constituents, Alaskans whose homes are already at risk. We've already reported on two villages that have to move because of rising sea levels and melting permafrost.
The entire villages in Alaska have to move.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
And just one more thing for Governor Palin. On this day, 40 years ago, Apollo 11 lifted off after President Kennedy set the goal to do things not because they were easy, but because they were hard.
We could do it then. We could do it now. For much more on that, check out our website, greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention
$24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Ten minutes past the hour of the second hour of tonight's edition of The Horn. And we are off to a roaring start in the first hour, if I do say so myself. We're going to go to the phones right here in just a second. As soon as I remember to mute my speakers so that we don't have all that nasty feedback there. That's much better. Someday I'm going to have a producer or a call screener and all kinds. Yes. But no, we're going to go to the phones and light them up if you want to. But we're going to start the hour. With a little conversation about something special that I mentioned at the beginning of the program, on the line is a member of our Horn family. If you've ever been in the chat room, you know her as Blythe Rain. And she came up with an idea a little bit ago, because in the real world she is one thing, but she is also very much, and this is so often the case with members of the Horn family, an artist. And you know how I feel about the arts. And she proposed an idea to me, and we're going to talk about it now and just lay it all out for you. Are you there, Diane?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful to have you on. Everything okay?
I am wonderful. I'm a little nervous, so I'll do my best.
No, you will do. You will do just fine. There are no sirens or bells or buzzers or right or wrong answers. And doggone it, we don't have any year's supply of Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat, to give you even.
Well, if you hear sirens on my end, it's just New York City. So.
Well, that's the music of the city.
That's right.
So you are an honest to goodness artist, and you contacted me a little while back and wanted to create a project that you thought would help the horn. Why don't you pick it up from there?
Okay. I am an artist. I'm actually, you know, by day I am a designer. But I really try to make projects for myself, because I think what happens is, when you start doing something you love as your job, you realize after a while that it's your job, and it kind of loses sometimes the, especially in the creative field, where people are like, oh, what do you get to design on a computer all day? That's so exciting. And it's like, yeah, it is exciting for a little while, but you don't always get to do what you want to do. So I try to make little projects for myself so I can keep the flow going, to be creative and to inspire myself. So I'm always online looking at what other people are doing, and it gets me excited about work, because sometimes you get in that rut as an artist and you don't know what to do. So I decided that actually around the time that we talked, that I wanted to teach myself how to screen print. I have a lot of friends that do it, and I have a very small apartment in New York, but I decided, like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to try to screen print. And then ultimately you get really excited about it and you get all your stuff, and then you have that blank sheet of paper in front of you. And you're like, oh, now what do I create? What do I do? And sometimes that's really frustrating. But before I had heard of your show, which I, you know, accidentally found on iTunes, it was so weird. Like, I was at work one day and I'm like, liberal radio? There's no such thing. And I clicked and I started listening, and I'm like, oh, I was so hooked from like the second I started listening. And then you started talking about mountaintop removal, and I'd never heard about mountaintop removal. I mean, my aunt is really big into environmental activism, and it's not something you hear about, especially in the Northeast. It's like, you know, there's not really any mountains in New York City, so.
Except the man-made ones.
Right. So I was like, wow, mountaintop removal. And then, you know, after you talked about it, and I did my own, you know, kind of research and reading about it, and you were just so passionate about this, and that just really inspired me. I'm like, you know, this is someone who lives a completely different lifestyle, in a completely different environment. And yeah, I felt so connected to what you were talking about. It was just like, I have to do something for this. I don't know what it is, but I have to do something. And so that's when I kind of came up with, like, this is going to be my first project. This is what I want it to be. And I got so excited about it. And I didn't stop talking about it. I'm sure my friends are totally, they don't want to hear about it anymore. The people I work with, and I'm like, I'm going to do this. You know, I just started talking about mountaintop removal all the time. And so I started doing a lot of sketching and trying to come up with ideas. And, you know, I know that I talked to you because I was like, well, what, you know, would you think this is a good idea if I came up with some artwork to make available for people who, you know, people who listen to the horn, but also, you know, everyone, to kind of educate them not only on mountaintop removal, but kind of what the horn does. So it's kind of a dual, it's in enjoying art, but also, you know, sending a message without being in your face. I didn't want something really accosting in my artwork, because I know a lot of artists that are very passionate about certain causes kind of scream at people, and I didn't really
want to get a little heavy-handed, as it were.
Right. You know, and that works. I mean, you know, in New York City, that's kind of I'm surrounded by that kind of artwork, because people here are not afraid you know, they're not afraid in their artwork to say what they mean, or sometimes they're very blatant or brash about the message they're trying to convey. And I thought, well, what is something nice that you wouldn't mind hanging in your home or looking at every day or having in your office that kind of has an uplifting message and at the same time contains information that, you know, maybe you can learn a little bit more about what the horn does and also about mountaintop removal. So the print that I created is a mountain print, and I'm calling it For Love of West Virginia. And it's...
Well, can I just tell you that when you shared all that with me, it gave me the chills. It just made me shiver. It is a beautiful thing. For the love of West Virginia, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. Please continue.
And I wanted to have artwork that that had a mountain scene. And my style is very graphic, and I do a lot of illustration, and I used to do a lot of children's illustration, and so my style is very graphic and very simple. And it's a scene of the mountains and the forest, and it also has a quote, and I really had a tough time deciding on a quote that I wanted to choose, sort of an inspirational quote for this, and I just did research upon research, and I came across this gentleman called John Muir, who was like one of the first environmentalists, and I read about him, and, you know, he was about saving mountains and the environment, and he had some wonderful quotes, and so so the quote I have on there, I chose from him, and you know, I'll read it to you. It says, "When one tugs at a single thing in nature, he finds it attached to the rest of the world." And I thought that was very fitting because, you know, with coal and all the stuff that you talk about mountaintop removal, it is attached to the rest of the world. Even if people aren't aware of, you know, they're not aware of where their energy is coming from, it's kind of like, you can't just take it and expect everything else to stay the same. And so it really struck a chord with me, and that's why I decided to use it. And so it's, I don't know. It's when I do the process, hand printing is, you know, some people don't understand it as an art because they're like, well, you're printing multiple prints of something, and they're like, oh, well, that's a machine can do that, but it's very
it's a very personal process, isn't it?
It is, and you know what, it really kind of absorbs you. I you know, hours go by and you have no idea. There's some weeks there where I didn't really know what time it was, because once you get involved in doing it, it's almost a zen state you go into. And you know, I mix inks by hand.
Oh my.
And Yeah, I know, right? It was new, and you know what's fun is because I had never done this before, so not only was it like, you know, I was really excited about doing it, but I was kind of just learning as I went along, so, you know, beginner's mistake, but it was...
But, you know, printmaking is an old and revered medium. If you go back to people like Blake, you know, the poet William Blake, was also a printmaker, and some of those things are, well, it's a wondrous art. So, you know, please don't sell that short. And I know exactly what kind of time has gone into this. You've made a run of them, have you not?
I have, yeah. When you do printmaking, you know, the machine that I have, because a lot of people, when they think printmaking, they think silk screening, and they have this idea of these huge frames. And if I had my own studio, I could afford to do that. But actually, the smart Japanese, developed a machine that is a compact version of a printmaking studio. So, being in New York is perfect for me to use it in my own place. But I still have to make the screens by hand. So it's just like a more compact version of the kind of silk screen process that everybody thinks, like, oh, T-shirts and stuff like that. So it's, I actually documented my process so that people could see how it was done, because you have to use different plates, and it's kind of interesting to see how the colors come together. And I even me doing it, I was printing the plates, and I'm like, oh, is this going to turn out okay? And then you get to the last plate, and you finish it, and you get all excited. I was so excited to see how it turned out.
Oh, I could feel the excitement vibrating off of the email itself when you wrote to me. It was just wonderful. And you also attached some images of the print. And what I have done is I've just emailed an image off so that folks can maybe see it in the chat room and on the website at headonradionetwork.com, which sort of leads into the rest of the story. But before going there, because it won't necessarily be obvious in the photograph, what is the size on this?
This is an 8.5 by 11 print.
Okay.
So it's standard letter size. There's about, I guess there's like a little bit more than a half inch border all around the actual print image. But it's 8.5 by 11, and it's on this heavy duty what they call cover stock by a company called French Papers. And interestingly enough, French Papers is the smallest American owned paper mill in America, and they actually run completely off hydroelectric power, and they have since the 20s.
Oh wow! So no connection to. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So the people that own it is in a family owned business. They are so nice, Gary and Terry French. They're the nicest people in the world, and they really care about the environment too. So, you know, I wanted to find paper that was consistent with the beliefs of the environment, because they feel it's very important. And all the papers they sell are recyclable. I didn't print on 100% recyclable content because I didn't know how it would turn out the first time. But, you know, if you have, I'm pretty sure they do something where if you have scrap or anything like that, you can actually send it back to them.
Though I can't imagine why anyone would want to in this instance.
Yes, we, you know, I mean, if you really got tired of the artwork.
No, but the beauty of this thing is it can fit inobtrusively in an office space or in a home office or on a wall in a bedroom or a living room. And just seeing it will create a mental key, a mnemonic, I suppose, is the word, although for all I know, I'm using the wrong one here, that will just create an awareness, because just like that John Muir quote, that's a linguistic embodiment of that little shorthand phrase that has become so prevalent down here that, you know, we're all downstream.
Right.
And that's exactly what the Muir quote addresses. So the photo that people will see is of it in a frame. I can envision it in offices. I can envision it in meeting halls, what have you. On the run, is run the proper phrase for this? In the run of the prints, how many did you make?
I made 120. 120 for this run. So it's limited, and pretty much I did as many as I could before the screens kind of destroy themselves. So that's how it kind of works in the screening process. You try to do as many as you can. But, there's only 120 of these.
And they are numbered and signed, right?
They are, yes. I hand numbered and signed them all. And what I did also is I typed up there's a card that comes with each print talking about the print, about you and the horn and mountaintop removal. And I included links to Coal River Mountain Watch, to I Love Mountains, to The Dirty Lie, all those links so that, you know, if people who purchase this print, or even if you gave it to a friend, you know, if you bought it and gave it to a friend, they could go and kind of see for themselves. You know, it's not, it's informative without being preachy. It's kind of like opening that door so that it's more of an inviting thing than kind of like, do you need to do this?
Right.
But, you know, and it also, I also included links to, White Rose Society. So, you know, if people get interested who may not listen to the horn regularly or they've heard about it, but they're not sure, they can go back, you know, to what Ben Birch has set up and kind of go back to your archives and listen to your show as well. As, you know, I know there's a lot of other shows on White Rose as well.
Well, I think this is just a brilliant idea, and it's such a kind and generous and sweet one as well. Because the underpinnings of this, Diane, were to create a physical thing that would encourage people to participate in keeping the horn alive and on the air. You'd set a price for it, and lo and behold, your buddies in the chat room, Texas Betsy, just asked, "What's she charging?" and you've also been a couple of other things. Pop in the chat room, please, was one message. And secondly, do you have a MySpace or a Facebook or anything like that, or a website? Or
I am so, I don't want to sound like pretentious, I am so anti-MySpace. Like, Facebook, I'm like I don't know. I do have a website. I'm actually in the process of redoing it. So, like, in the next couple days here, it'll be all brand fresh and new, and I'll have my new blog up and everything. But my website right now, if you go to it, will have, like, just a forewarning, will have all my old artwork on it from, like, when I was in college, because that's how lazy I've been about updating it. But if you do just, you know, if you want to bookmark it and just go back and say, oh, it's so pretty now after I update it, it's DG, which are my initials, Diane Grohl, and then a hyphen, and Design Studio, it's all one word, .com.
Okay, do it one more time, please.
DG, hyphen, Design Studio, .com.
Excellent. I understand what you mean. A website can it gets to the point where you don't own it so much as it owns you.
And you know what, web design, you know, is extremely foreign area to me. It's not my expertise. You know, I'm a physical person. I need to touch things. That's why I'm a package designer. So when you deal with web space, I'm just like, oh gosh.
Yeah, lost. But because you can't see it, you can't hold it up, you can't turn it around, you can't, how wide is it, how thick is it, how tall is it, right, exactly.
And this language that they use, this programming language, it's easier to learn French or something. I just can't wrap my head around it. I'm like, oh my gosh, these symbols, what do they mean? But
it's
almost all together, so I'm excited it'll be launching soon.
So if someone does want to purchase one of these, how do they go about doing it?
Well, that is a good question. I'm going to have my blog, like I said, I'm updating in a couple days. It's going to be available through my blog. But I was thinking, if you want to, we can also make it available through the Horn website. Because I know a lot of people are already familiar with the Horn website, but everything would be done by PayPal, because that's the glory of PayPal.
Yes.
So,
although it must be noted, Diane, there are some people who don't like to deal with PayPal.
I know there are.
And for valid reasons, I might add. So we might have to work up some sort of an alternative, but. I didn't mean to interrupt. They will be available, and so you're going to we'll put it up on the Horn website. You're going to put it up on your website, and then what happens?
And then, ta-da! No, and then hopefully, you know, if anyone starts ordering, I will start shipping them out. That's how it works. So I, you know, hopefully, you know, we can raise enough money. I'm excited.
Oh, I am too. And the idea that there's something physical that physical reminder just gets all over me. And well, each one of these is hand numbered and signed. They are of an extremely limited quantity. And hopefully we'll run through this run before we know what happened.
I hope so. I mean, if it does really well and people really kind of like this idea, and I am just itching to do something else. I mean, I would love to make this kind of, you know, something. I don't know if we could. I have to work, but, you know, I would love it to be a monthly thing. I can't.
That might put a little bit too much on you. I mean, come on.
But, I mean, I would like every couple of months to kind of come out with something new and something fresh, and maybe not always a print, but maybe a set of note cards, something you can use correspondence, because I know that's kind of a dead art, but I'll tell you what, I love writing letters to people. I still do it. And I can't have enough stationery. It's the sickness of me.
You're a Renaissance woman, you know that?
I still write with a quill, if you can believe it. Like, I believe in the handwriting letters. I miss that, you know.
And writing with a nice, you know, I think I've gone off on one of my geeky moments in the past, Diane. The idea of penmanship. That used to be a taught course, and I don't know that it was a bad thing. For instance, if you go back into, the records room of some courthouse, and you go back and start looking at deeds from, say, you know, the 1800s, or if you look at the handwriting on the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, that's a radically different style of written English that, frankly, is far more elegant than what we do now.
Right. I know. The email's just not the same, you know, especially when you want to, you know, writing is very emotional. And I think when, you know, you read that something handwritten, that comes through, you know, especially, and it's not always positive. You know, I know when some people get upset, they write very frantically, but it's so stagnant over, you know, the digital sort of way of doing things now that it's never grasped me. You know, if I need to write something really meaningful, I don't do it over email. I always send a letter.
Well, you know, it's there's nothing weird about it at all, because that's directly in line with the things that I've heard in our recent trips to D.C. time and time and time again. People on Capitol Hill saying, you know, if you really want to get the senator's attention, if you really want the congressman to know that you're serious about whatever it is you're talking about, sit down and write a letter. Take a pen, get the paper.
The experience, yeah. I mean, it's the experience of opening it and touching the paper, and, you know, I think it's a sensorial thing. And I think that's why books will never go away. You know, a lot of people are, you know, old books, they're so, you know, people are getting those Kindles, and, like, you know, that's something you see a lot of on the subway. Like, people read a lot in New York City because you're on the train, you know, and you have nothing better to do. So, but books, I could never get over reading something online, like, that was extremely extended. I have to, you know, I have to hold it, and, you know, I still have a journal. You know, this blogging that I'm going to start doing is very new to me, because I write in a journal still, and I take my journal everywhere. But but I'm trying to, you know, I'm like, gosh, I'm part of that generation. I got to catch up. I'm like the only person in New York City that doesn't have an iPod, I swear.
Well, and see, I'm a little bit that way in my own right, Diane, because you know, we've entered at this age of tweeting, and God, I sound like a geezer, I guess. and instant messaging and stuff, and it because the devices are so tiny and you type with your thumbs, using whole words has gone out the window. And I'm resistant of that. If I say your, I type your, not you are. I use for, for, fore, and four, in their grammatical fashion, and never substitute with the numeral. I think if I really wanted to be a geek about it, I could start cheating and using IV, and replace, and you know, that would mess with them, wouldn't it?
I always found it hilarious, kind of when text messaging became a huge thing. I was like, isn't it more complicated to kind of relearn how to type words in a shorter fashion? Like, I still, if I ever text message anyone, I still spell everything out. People are like, doesn't that take you forever? I'm like, well, it's harder for me to think of how to not spell it right.
Yeah, and then there are even programs that anticipate what the word is, and you choose the word, and it spells it all the way through. But it's just I catch my kids doing it, and I'm like, stop it. It's a word, you know, and then suddenly I'm having my Annie Sullivan, Helen Keller at the water pump. It's a word. It has a meaning.
It's true. We're becoming so dependent on technology to really kind of help us along. It's definitely a disservice. I mean, I admit, like, I am, I'm sure my mother would cringe, but my mom teaches, you know, she's the best English, you know, teacher ever. And she knows everything about grammar and, you know, I, for some reason, growing up, I just can't spell to save my life. It's horrible. And I'm always, you know, going to a dictionary or, you know, because even if I like to use the words, it's like, how do you spell that, you know? But I don't rely on a computer to tell me what word it thinks I want to use. It's like, no, I'm going to go and look it up, and then that's how you learn how to spell it. Looking it up enough times, and then you realize, oh, I before E, Diane, I before E. You know,
except after C, or in months that don't have R's in them.
Right.
Yeah. What?
All those rules, you know. I used to have a friend that was like, how do you use commas? I just put them anywhere.
Well, you know, my favorite, you know, it's a sad commentary on me, Diane, that I have, I was about to say, my favorite joke about a piece of punctuation. That concept would even exist in my mind just shows what a sad, sad thing I am. But Kurt Vonnegut used to say that the only thing a semicolon is for is to prove that someone has been to college.
See, and that's so true, because you know what? When, you know, the semicolon is such a, you never ever see it. Although, you know, the new thing to do, and this is a sad state of affairs, because, you know, even in my business, in professional, people do this, and I'm actually appalled by it, but typing emails and correspondence in a business fashion, I mean, you would really think that you would want to portray at least the facade of being professional, but people don't capitalize. They don't use punctuation. They do the pause thing as if the pause is really happening. So it's like dot, 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 and then they continue typing. So it's like one.
Well, see, yeah, and that was one of the things that drove me crazy about the remember back when Sarah Palin quit a couple of weeks ago? The Friday before the 4th of July?
Thing.
Yeah, and I went and I, you know, the official state of Alaska website, right? And I went and I read the statement, and it was like, it was written like it was texted into the internet. You know, because there were parentheses with exclamation points and ellipses, and it's like,
What? Did Piper Palin do this for you, Sarah? But no, there's somebody in the State House that doesn't, there's somebody in the State House in Alaska who doesn't know that that's not good English.
Right. No proofreading. It's like, or people who are, or type, the way that they talk. And it's, you're like, you're having a conversation with someone, which is okay, I guess, if you're having correspondence between friends, it's a little bit different, but just, you know, it's absolutely floors me. I try not to have to be on email at my work too often, but I crack up at some of the stuff I get in my inbox.
You know, and I, one of the beauties, and you know this because you've been in the chat room, one of the beauties is of this whole thing that we've got going here is the conversation that gets engendered between in the conversations over the air and how that takes off in the chat room. For instance, we've got a big "I'm with you, Bob" from Texas Betsy here, and her comment earlier: "My son inserts a comma every 6 words, whether he needs it or not."
Right, just in case you have to, just to take a breath.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll just, if it doesn't belong there, it belongs somewhere.
That's the first thing.
There's no such thing as a lonely comma.
Oh.
And I'm going through it now with our own kids, and the funny thing is, you know, for me, when I got into high school, God, back when I rode to school on the back of a dinosaur. When I started ninth grade in English and they were talking about the proverbs and adjectives and nouns and, you know, this was all stuff that I was supposed to pick up in fifth grade, but was incredibly bored by. But I got into Latin and all of a sudden it mattered. And that did more to make me understand English than anything else, anything, bless their hearts, any English teacher did. It's not necessarily that I write English with Latin grammar. But it just gives you a sense of order and why things work the way they do. Lord only knows how I would write had I not had that. It certainly.
I wish I had taken Latin. That's something I kind of regret. My brother actually did, and he's probably doing a little bit better than I am. But I think, you know, with writing, it's just that people, the only writing they really do is, you know, instant messaging someone or text messaging them on the phone. A lot of people, they don't write. And so, you know, if you never ever have to do it or do it right, you forget that there is a right way. it just kind of doesn't matter to you anymore. And I think that's what's happening, you know, what's happening to people who I find, and oh, God help me, I have to deal with marketing people.
Oh, so you probably have the Bill Hicks clip bookmarked at home. Are you in marketing?
Oh my gosh. I remember the first time I saw that and I like fell out of my chair. I was like, this is so spot on. There's a couple of skits.
Oh, he's going for the angry dollar. That's a good dollar.
I hate to say it, but it is so true. You sit in meetings with these people, and your mouth would hit the floor. I can't even tell you. I've been in these situations where, well, I've been in situations, perfect example, a couple days ago, where they're talking about the use of this product, and they're using words that don't exist. And so I kind of raise my hand, and I'm just the designer, you know, so that no one ever listens. You know, they're like, oh, you're just the designer, whatever. But I'm like, you know, that's not a word. And this girl looked at me right in the face and said, well, I Googled it. And I just said, just because you Googled it doesn't mean it's a real word.
You know, the beauty of the connections of and everything that happens on the horn, you've heard me mention him in the past. I can't emphasize enough that where this topic is concerned, Diane, you have to avail yourself of some time, and I know how precious time is, but you have to avail yourself of some time just wandering around Eugene Finnerman's Your RDA of Irony over at FinnermanWorks.com, because Eugene writes for corporate clients. And he has stories that are similar to the one you just laid out. And words like, the one that drove me crazy back when I was playing it, trying to be a real journalist, is, you'd pick up the phone and say, do you have anything more about the building fire in Poughkeepsie? And they'd say, we're efforting a response, sir. You're efforting? Really? I didn't know you could do that with that. And you're absolutely right in what you point out, that they just make stuff up.
It's all about me. That's like the new thing to do. It's like, we're just going to make up this word. And a lot of times people do that so that they can't get sued. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It's like, if you make up something that does something and you've never heard of what that is, it's probably because they just made it up to make it sound really amazing. And you can't prove that it doesn't do that because the word doesn't really mean anything. You know, and I swear, anytime anyone wants to say anything about a project, it's something technology. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just, they just put technology behind it, and it becomes...
Right, we're going to use our new wheeled cart technology to take the office supplies down the hallway to each cubicle.
And, you know, when I was first starting out in the business, I worked for a toy company, and because it was so small and it was, run like a sweatshop, I was not only the package designer, but I was also the copywriter, and I did all the instruction manuals and everything. And because of this, because I had power, I would just exploit it and just, use the stupidest language I could think of. I'm like, okay, what do we say about this? We say, dual fusion technology. That's what we'll say. And it was such a big joke. And like, they would print it, and it would be printed, and it would be like in every Walmart in the universe. And I would crack up that they actually used it. I'm like, I can't believe they just used dual fusion technology. I can't believe it.
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, it reminds me of that wonderful passage in Joseph Heller's Catch-22, where Captain Yossarian is assigned to, it's all set in the Second World War, and he's assigned to censor the letters home from the enlisted men to make sure, ostensibly to make sure that no sensitive information is being conveyed, but he decides to make a game of it. And so one day he just censored all the prepositions, and then one day he censored all the nouns in all the letters. And the next day he did all the verbs, and then he got it. He raised it to a high art, and he just censored everything. And then at the bottom wrote, "I yearn for you madly, A.T. Tapman Chaplin." and that's what it does to you, and it creeps into your own mind. I caught myself, Diane. I caught myself the other day turning the word status into a verb. In other words, I a past tense verb at that. I said something had been statused. And I looked down and I went, and it was like one of those Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, but what is happening to me?
I have to check myself too, because you when you're surrounded by it, it can't help but like integrate itself kind of into your lifestyle. And even though I know how much a sham half the stuff is out there, because I work on it, and I have to warn people. It's like you don't want to buy that. Trust me, I worked on that. But like, you start to, when you go to all these meetings and people are talking about how fantastic everything is, you can't help but kind of be like kind of brainwashed by it a little bit. Like, you're like, this is an excellent product. It is amazing and innovative. And you're like, it doesn't kill you because you inhale it over a certain amount of time, It's just, I have to be careful in my own, like, advertising and marketing is.
Yeah, because once it gets past you, and then it goes through marketing, and once it leaves marketing, it goes to legal.
I know, and by God, the conversations I have had with legal department, it is amazing how afraid people are of getting sued for saying something, yet at the same time, what they can claim because of how the law is written blows your mind, especially in cosmetics. I mean, to say something has you know, real pearl in it. Let's say they say, okay, you use this skin product. It makes you useful because it has real pearl in it. Well, they can say real pearl as long as it's like 0.00023% pearl in the actual formula.
Yes.
It can be so non, it doesn't even do anything, but they can claim that it does all this stuff because pearl has X amount of qualities that are proven to do certain things.
Well, yeah, and that's something that is as old as human ingenuity itself, Diane, because, we know that there was branding in ancient Rome, for instance, and in ancient Asia. Now with rhinoceros horn.
Yeah.
And it's all, you know, there's some P.T. Barnum aspects to it, of course. But the other thing I love is the, you know, you can say with real pearl. But the funny thing is, if it says pearlescent, then that means there's never been a pearl anywhere near it. But we've tried to make it pearl-like. And I've said before, I'm such a label geek. I mean, I'm just nasty about labels. My kids won't go to the grocery store with me anymore because they'll bring, Daddy, can we have some chocolate syrup? And I'll look down at the you know, off-brand bottle of chocolate syrup, and I'll say, only if you bring me a bottle of chocolate syrup.
Right.
What do you mean?
Chocolate flavor.
See, son, it says chocolate flavored.
Right.
That means there's no chocolate in it. Really?
I crack up because people now, because of this kind of just assuming everything on a box or an advertising is true, you get these crazy cases of people suing over things that you wouldn't even think would get to court. And an article I read not too long ago was about this woman who was suing who makes Captain Crunch, I think, like Kellogg's or you know, one of those companies.
General Mills, Post.
General Mills, right. She was suing General Mills because she thought that Crunch Berries.
I knew it was going to be Crunch Berries. I knew it. I knew it was going to be Crunch Berries.
And it got to a level in court of like actual, you know, being kind of serious. And I'm thinking, like, she was really distraught. And she's like, well, I thought a Crunch Berry was a real berry. And it's because of crap like that that you see, you know, not actual size or enlarged to show texture or Crunch Berries are not real berries. And you think to yourself, who would think a Crunch Berry is a real? Well, I know Snozberries exist, but Crunch Berries.
Right, right. No. Yeah, objects in mirror may be larger than they appear. No, really?
I mean, that part of my job has to be some of the most hilarious. And in fact, I try to laugh at pretty much everything I do because I'm like, yeah, do you really need to tell someone not to swallow ammonia cleaner, like not to drink it? Do you really need to tell them that?
Oddly enough, you do because I don't mean to be too graphic, but one of my wife Agnes's favorite stories from her days in the medical profession. Had to do with the doctor that she was working for, and she, of course, was the, you know, she comes in and she does the okay, and here's your prescription, and here's your medicine, and you know, call us if there's any problem. And the guy she was working for was, I guess, a proctologist or a surgeon or something, and he had done hemorrhoid surgery on this guy. And so she comes in and she gives him the medication, you know, and they're wrapped up in little foil packets and stuff. And says, you know, you need to take this medication once every 4 hours. And Agnes is no slouch. I mean, she went, you know, she goes, if she's got a list, she's going to go through it, okay? And the guy comes back a couple of days later, and he says, I'm in terrible pain. And she says, well, did you take the medicine as directed? He said, yep. And he said, it's just tearing me to pieces. And it turns out the guy has not taken the foil packaging off. She had another patient who was swallowing them.
Oh, my God.
And, but, you know, those people are out there, you know, smart alecks in the chat room. Oh, I guess my booberry is safe, or thank God my Count Chocula is okay.
And oh, yeah, and there's Lottie. Oh, can you imagine grape nuts? Yeah. No grapes.
Right.
No grapes in grape nuts.
It's not even a nut.
It's not even...
neither of those things.
Right. I remember when Ewell Gibbons was advertising him, which is probably before your time. But I said, well, you know, Mom, I'd like to have a box of grape nuts. They look really healthy. And she says, well, okay, but you're going to hate them, son. I said, well, what makes you? She said, because you can't chew them. She said, you can
I
leave
have, I, yes. I, you know, I have a hilarious story about grape nuts. About when I was really small, when I was really little, my dad used to eat grape nuts, like, every day. And because Dad was eating them, I wanted to eat them, too. And my dad's like, you don't want to eat these. You're not going to like it. And I was so stubborn as a kid. I'm like, no, I want to eat them. And he's like, well, how about you try a little bit and see if you like it? And I was just like, no, I want a whole bowl.
I want my own bowl. Yeah.
That's right. I want my own bowl of grape nuts. And so they pour me this huge bowl of grape nuts and the milk. And I take one bite. I think I, like, spit them out everywhere. And I'm like, I don't like this. And I, you know, carry on. And my dad's like, well, you're going to eat them. You want to be like me. You got to sit and eat the whole bowl. And I remember crying and crying and crying. And being like, he's like, no, because you didn't want to listen to me. Now you're going to eat the whole bowl. And I was like, well, what if I don't eat the whole bowl? He's like, then for lunch, you're going to have grape nuts. And I remember him, like, putting the foil over the bowl, putting it in the fridge, and me, like, agonizing about having to eat this bowl. And coming to lunch, and then putting the bowl in and not taking the foil off, taking the bowl and saying, Diane, you're going to eat the grape nuts. And I said, no, Daddy, I don't want to eat them. He's like, okay, well, you're going to be hungry, and guess what you're going to have for dinner? And I remember, and I'm like, no, Daddy. And he's like, he said, Diane, are you going to listen to me from now on about the grape nuts and about other things when I tell you you're not going to like them? And I said, yes, Daddy, I promise. So I remember coming back to dinner and then putting the bowl of grape nuts. And I took the foil off, and the grape nuts were all gone. And he said, you don't have to eat the grape nuts, but are you ever going to eat them? Are you ever going to ask me again? And I said, no, Daddy. I never ate grape nuts for that day. I don't think I ever went back to, and I listened to my dad from then on. Because I was scarred by the forcing to eat the grape nuts, but they are gross. I love cereal. I'm a cereal fiend. I will eat cereal any time of day. I'm like, have this weird Seinfeld complex. Like, you know, if I don't know what I want to eat for dinner, I'm like, I'll just have some cereal.
I think we all go through. My son can go through an entire box of cereal without even trying. He's got the metabolism of like six people or something. Yeah. Well, this has been a delightful conversation, Diane, and I hope you'll chime in anytime you feel like you survived, didn't you? Hey, look.
I did survive. I was so nervous, but now I feel so much better.
And so, as a consequence, you will never be shy about calling in again. So we have inaugurated this little project, and we will move forward on it. And folks will be able to see it at the website. I've already had a couple of requests to see it via email, and the print has gotten some very nice praise. So hopefully you'll be fresh out of them before we know what happened.
Well, that's a good thing. And then people can start enjoying them personally.
Exactly. And be reminded of a number of things, including probably this conversation. Every time they look at it. Diane, thank you so much. Thank you for what you've done, and thank you for a lovely conversation.
Oh, thank you, Bob. You have a good night.
Oh, you too. We'll talk soon, okay?
Okay.
All right, bye now.
Bye.
So the prints will be available for sale in the very near future, and I certainly hope you'll avail yourself of Diane's hard work. It's not very often that you get a chance like this. It's something this original and something that comes from this close to the heart. So, you know, keep an eye on the website. I'll let you know when everything is all set up. And you've got Diane's web address. And that's how it's going to go. Where did that hour go? What a wonderful conversation. That was just a delight. Well, there's more delight on the way, if you wish. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. Direct dial is 304-658-3333. And email, of course, comes into bobkincaid@gmail.com. We'll take our little top of the hour break and come back to your calls, and I promise I am going to get to the real reason Jeff Sessions is the way he is. And you will understand so much when that happens. And so in commemoration of Diane's print, which in itself commemorates the beauties of Appalachia and everything that's special about it and everything that is worth saving about Appalachia, a cut from Still Moving Mountains, The Journey Home. You've heard cuts from this before. This is magnificent stuff from Aurora Lights Music. You should probably have a copy of this, too. We'll be right back. This is The Horn.
Down in my bed. Tonight's final hour of Head On begins next. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
I was just looking over what remains in the stack this evening, and it looks like we are going to wind up where we started. It's going to be a parade of morons. It just is. Or, you know, since we're talking about Repiglickens, morans. Yeah. But let's do this first. Because I love, oh, merciful God, I love great audio. It's why, well, that and the fact that I've got a face made for radio is why I ain't in TV. I ain't all pretty with the good hair. But I do love me some good audio. And you will not get choice stuff like this just every day. This stuff doesn't just come along whenever you're looking for it. You know, the real star of the Sonia Sotomayor hearings, in a sort of perverse way, has been Jefferson Beauregard Sessions Lapood. And today was really the... If every liberal talk show host in the country does not clip this out and hang on to it like grim death and play it every time his crazy-ass name is mentioned, there's something wrong with us. During the hearings, Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, said something this afternoon in the course of a conversation with a witness by the name of Wade Henderson, who is the president and CEO of the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights. Did I mention that Mr. Henderson is black? And any time... Because he's, see, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions Lafleur is immensely uncomfortable around people darker than him. Because just like Jeffrey Toobin at CNN said, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is comfortable and happy believing that he lives in a world where he lives in this sort of genderless, colorless, the little white wonderland. And he gets all stupid when he's around people of color, you know, darker folk. And today was just the crowning for a man, for a man who once warned an African-American fellow worker to be careful what he says around the white women folk. For a man who thought the Klan was cool until he found out they smoked the marijuana. Today was just a moment of genius. Now, bear in mind, let me just set the scene for you, if I may. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III was sitting in his little Senate seat, and he was... other witnesses were around. The mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, was there. Former FBI director Louis Freeh was there. And God and everybody was watching. When Jefferson Beauregard Sessions Lafleur tried to make himself feel at ease and comfortable with Wade Henderson. Herein is the result. And now we know why Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is the way Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III is.
I feel better already. Oh, that's good. Mr. Attorney General, thank you for your able comments. And Mr. Henderson, it's good to work with you. Senator Leahy and I are talking during these hearings. We're going to do that crack cocaine.
Yeah, you going to do that? Crack cocaine.
I want you to know. I want to make absolutely double darn sure that you understand I have not fooled with that audio in any way, shape, form, or fashion. That is played straight up as it happened. Oh, I got to hear it again.
I feel better already. Oh, that's good.
Bet you
Mr.
do.
Mr. Attorney General, thank you for your able comments. And Mr. Henderson, it's good to work with you. Senator Leahy and I are talking during these hearings. We're going to do that crack cocaine.
And he points at him when he says that crack cocaine. Yeah. Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III says we're going to do that crack cocaine and points at the black man. You know, if he came from any state other than Alabama or Mississippi or Georgia or Arkansas or South Carolina, that would be enough to end his Senate career. We're going to do that crack cocaine! Woo! Great heavenly days. Now, to be fair, he's not saying he's going to do crack cocaine. It would show a lack of integrity on my part if I did not play the clip in full. What he is doing is he is being condescending to Mr. Henderson, because Mr. Henderson's group, as have many others, have pointed out for years, if not decades, that the federal sentencing guidelines are vastly more harsh on criminal defendants of color who are caught with crack cocaine than they are on white people who were caught with powder cocaine. It is a sentencing inequity of monumental proportions. So Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III wants the black man to understand that Mars Sessions is working on something to help him. This, then, is the entire clip.
I feel better already. Oh, that's good. Mr. Attorney General, thank you for your able comments. And Mr. Henderson, it's good to work with you. Senator Leahy and I...
Yeah, it's good to work with you. Sure it is. Sure it is, Jefferson. Sure it is.
I feel better already. Oh, that's good. Mr. Attorney General, thank you for your able comments. And Mr. Henderson, it's good to work with you. Senator Leahy and I, I'm talking during these hearings, we're going to do that crack cocaine thing that you and I have talked about before. We got to.
thank you, Senator. I appreciate
it. I want to restate that.
I'm trying to be so careful with this clip because this thing is just a quart bottle of nitroglycerin waiting to explode all over me. Maybe it's because I have access to the video and you don't. If you want to see this. It's under the politics tab at Huffington Post. Headline, Jeff Sessions, we're going to do that crack cocaine thing video. Here, let me just do this real quick. I'll pop it into the chat room for you guys. This is a horror show. This is the essence of the entrenched racism that goes all the way to the very center of Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III's very being. And the embarrassed laughter. See, they're not laughing necessarily
This is embarrassed, nervous laughter.
Because, you know, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, he's hard on drugs.
My God, the lives that he destroyed when he was U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Alabama over so-called drug cases. And sweet Jesus, the number of people of African-American descent that he would have gladly and gleefully sent up the river had the Senate not come to its senses and rejected him as a nominee to the federal bench can scarcely be contemplated. Listen to the laughter and see if they're laughing at a faux pas, or are they laughing out of a sort of nervous uneasiness in watching an old, unreconstructed racist at work.
I feel better already. That's good. Mr. Attorney General, thank you for your able comments. And Mr. Henderson, it's good to work with you. Senator Leahy and I are talking during these hearings. We're going to do that crack cocaine thing that you and I have talked about before. We got to.
Thank you, Senator. I appreciate
it. I want to restate that.
You might want to be. Let me correct the record.
Please rephrase it, Senator. Please rephrase.
I misspoke.
No, quite all right.
We're going to reduce the burden of penalties in some of the crack cocaine cases and make them fair.
Yeah, just some of those crack cocaine cases and make them fair. Are you admitting, Senator Sessions, that those crack cocaine laws that you have in your own past ardently advocated for, are you admitting that they're unfair? That will come as quite interesting to a number of people who are rotting in the federal prison system because of you and people like you. My Lord in heaven. And that's nervous laughter. There's no way to get around that. Let's see if that really was a phone call. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Bob. This is Lee in Texas. I spoke.
Hey, Lee, how are you?
I'm doing good. I actually wanted to call in last night on prayer meeting. I guess I've mentioned you before. I too am a recovering Southern Baptist.
It's a hard road, isn't it, brother?
Oof, yeah. The session stuff is amazing, by the way. And I was listening to it, and like I was going to call last night, but I got a new kitten and got real busy. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. The kittens are like that.
Yeah. But I thought I heard you make reference to Sessions is making a deal with the Obama Justice Department to keep Siegelman.
Yes.
To go after the same prosecutor.
Or
keep the guy in place. I mean, I'm sorry.
Yes, that was what I read. It was at a blog called Legal Schnauzer. I don't have the link in front of me right now, but the story being reported is that the Obama administration has reached a deal with Senator Sessions and Senator Shelby, the senatorial pair from Alabama, to keep the George Bush prosecutorial team in place and allow them to continue handling the utterly unjust, utterly thoroughly criminal prosecution of Don Siegelman.
Jesus. I don't even know what to say, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of breathtaking, isn't it?
Yeah, I hate to sit there and just go, we've all been had, you know, but I don't know anymore, you know? Of course, I was a Kucinich guy, so, you know.
Same here.
I thought we had been had in that first debate he got froze out of.
Indeed, and I think you're right. And in subsequent pageants, when they wanted to ask him about UFOs and Shirley MacLaine, and whether he was tall enough to be president, and boy, your wife sure is pretty, and aren't you a vegetarian, sir? I get mad just thinking about it, Lee. I really, really do. But, if this, you know, this was not reported as it's a done deal, it was reported that it is being rumored that. And if it does, in fact, turn out to be the case that, you know, I keep having these moments, and a lot of the Horn listeners do too, Lee, where they say, okay, that's it. I'm done with Barack Obama. And I'm going to be hard-pressed not to cross one of those lines with this if this goes down.
Right. Well, and, you know, the other thing is, I mean, I'll sit there and I'll talk to people, and, of course, they don't listen to Malloy or you. Yeah, and I've, by the way, I'm really into the food porn angle of the show, by the way.
Oh, bring some anytime.
So do you use bacon drippings for your gravy?
Oh, gosh, yes. Well, bacon drippings sometimes. Bacon grease for a pan of fried potatoes. Ho-ho! Uh-huh. I love some sausage gravy. And that. Of course, I live in a place where we get real worked up about squirrel gravy, too. Now, I've just put off 99% of the audience by saying that. Squirrel gravy's good.
So I've gone back. I finally figured out the iTunes thing, and part of it was my misspelling your last name. But got the podcast from Ben on the iTunes, and there was so much stuff I wanted to touch on, and I mean, I really wanted to save some of it for last, or tried to get in last night, you know, but like I said, this kitten thing came up. But one of them would be the numbers 1853, and it was from the call of the woman in Arizona.
Okay.
The 18 minutes and 53 seconds it took for them to respond.
Yes.
And just listening to that whore. I mean, I sat there driving around listening like I'd just been feeling like I'd just been, you know, kicked in the shorts. And you know, I didn't have anything to go through. You know, in fact, that was when I was going, when is this going to end? Please tell me this is almost over. You know, and then, so I said, okay, I'll go back and listen to some other podcasts of yours. And I caught the... And that put me in a foul mood, too. I caught the 11-year-old boy from I don't know where that had already had his brain warped and was just a little hate monger.
Oh, the kid from Pennsylvania.
Oh.
Oh, you have been in the time machine, haven't you?
Yeah, pretty much.
Some of those you come out needing a shower, my friend. You really, really do.
Right. Well, I always feel like I need one in Texas, just, you know, with guys like John Cornyn and our governor, what's his name, McGarrett.
Rick Goodhair Perry, yeah,
that's the one.
You know, you are gonna have one Jim Dandy Repig Lickin primary. Kay Bailey Hutchinson and Rick Goodhair Perry. I mean, this is gonna be a steel cage death match.
Yeah, and you know what's annoying? I live in a town that's got a lot of this smart growth stuff, in Austin, and you've got dudes like what's his name, Kinky Friedman, that runs every once in a while. And or ran last time, and he's running again, and it's just a lark for this guy. And it's like, you know, dude, I know you didn't have that many real big hits, and you know, you still draw a decent crowd at the Broken Spoke, and you come in and hold court, and now you're going to run for governor. It's like, you know, quit being a prick. Why don't you run for mayor of Austin, where you could actually win and do something? But, you know, we had things like, and it started with this guy named Kirk Watson, who's a state rep now. Or state senator, I can't remember which, but he was a mayor, and he's one of these guys that came in and took all the public stuff. I mean, just kept, you know, chipping away at all the public parkland and putting up, you know, a Starbucks or a Wendy's or, you know, something we don't really need. So you can't.
Yeah, just anything to destroy a little bit more of the commons.
Yes, yes. And so, yeah, sorry, I'm like all over the place, but yeah, there's so many synchronicities that I've run into, you know, listening to the show, and so. Whether it be the movie references or whatever. Doug, you're mentioning of the Coen brothers last night to the, I can't remember her name. I think she called
her. No, that was Kate. That was Kate.
But anyway, so, yeah, I guess that's pretty much everything. But, you know, I wanted to call and try and have my head a little bit better together. But, you know, some of the topics that you guys have hit on, just, you know, a bunch of them are just knockout punches. And so, unfortunately, I'm the
well,
one
you know, it happens
driving down the highway.
It happens to me too, because, you know, usually I've been through a story or something two or three times before I get behind the microphone with it, Lee, and even after two or three times, I'm still just the thing with Glenn Beck last night, screaming, you know, the professional radio host Glenn Beck, screaming in that sort of high pitched balls in a vice kind of thing that he. And even on air, I'm just left going, because I can't, these right wing, do their advertisers ever listen to their shows? Apparently not.
I'm guessing they just look at the ratings. And that is one of the drags. Like, I've got two brothers on active duty, and they've both been over to both Afghanistan and Iraq two times apiece now, you know. So four deployments in, what, 5 years or something like that, you know. And so one's back over in Afghanistan, and the other one that's a captain is actually at the Defense Language Institute out there in Monterey or whatever. You know, real pretty, and I'm glad it takes a while to learn to speak Arabic, but you're going, you know, here's the deal where there were, they had translators, but they got rid of them just based on their orientation, you know.
Yeah,
and
they're not teaching, like, right, and they're not teaching him to speak Arabic to go be a recruiter in Flint, Michigan either.
No, they're teaching him to speak Arabic because we're never leaving. You know, and that just drives me berserk. I mean, and I was in the first cav for the whole build-up and then the Desert Shield / Storm and then the drawdown over there. And, like I said, I woke up, I don't know, somewhere right about the time I started listening to Bill Hicks. But
that'll do it.
But, yeah. And so, like, for example, for whatever reason, I don't think my dad was blocking my emails. But, you know, I kept sending him stuff. I was like, here. And he's as big a Luddite as I am. You know, I suck with a lot of gadgets and all that stuff. But so I was like, look, just go Google the Great American Bubble Machine, Dad, please. You know, and I get an email back that just says, son of a bitch. You know, and so, I mean, there's stuff that he's kind of woken up to. At the same time, I still get all this. I got one. I lived without power here in Texas this last year. I was in a wreck, and I didn't have power in my apartment from, like, September to February of this year.
Oh, man.
I did a lot of things, like I'd go sell plasma, blood, not TVs. And I had a phone that way, and I'd go buy AA batteries, and I'd put them in a radio by the window so they thought the power was still on if the apartment manager happened to come walking by or whatever. Sneaky. But, you know.
Man, that's way too creative for anybody's own good.
Yeah, musician thing, I guess. But, you know. So
again,
so,
with the artist. What do I keep saying? Yeah.
I get things like, you know what drives me nuts? And it's my folks are, they're Reformed Presbyterians, which is pretty much hyper-Calvinist, too.
Yes.
And it was, I guess, what was the deal that whole bunch of Presbyterians split when they started ordaining women.
Right, right. And that, and I think that's the brand of Presbyterian that the departed D. James Kennedy of Coral Snake Ministries, Coral Snake Ministries in Florida was from, you know, and he inveighed constantly against... Well, you know, the usual suspects.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. And so, but I mean, I would get the emails from this church, and they are such hateful stuff. It was like, you know, Michelle Obama goes to a soup kitchen and she's talking to a homeless guy, and what were they focusing on? How did a homeless guy have a cell phone? I went, hey, I was next to homeless, and I had a cell phone. And they're like, well, how does he have, how do they know where to send his bill? And I'm like, you know, you go down to a pay station?
Oh, yeah, they're so divorced from reality that they don't know about go phones or track phones or anything that people who are struggling to survive will access in order to maintain some level of contact. How are you supposed to get work without a phone number? At least you got a track phone with some minutes on it.
Exactly. Yeah, now I don't know where the guy got his $20 or whatever, but you know that wasn't the point. The point was anybody can get one, you know. My kid brother, the one that's over in Afghanistan, I just got the email the other day that you had mentioned or Mike had mentioned, and it's the one with the Obama healthcare plan, and they've got him in, you know, African tribal dress.
Yes.
And I'm just like, come on, Evan. You know what the hell? You know, it's you know. I don't support the warrior, and I sure as hell support you getting home, you know. But, you know, that's the other thing, though. If all they're getting is Stars and Stripes or all they're listening to is Rush or, you know, or any of the corporate stuff, I'll sit there and mention something that I've heard on the horn or on Mike's show, and they look at me, you know, like I've got three heads. Or, as Hicks said, like a dog that's just been shown a card trick.
You know? God, I love that one.
So, you know, I, you know, it's, I pretty much sometimes feel like I need to walk into a studio just, you know, it's got the sound isolation and just scream, you know.
Yeah, for a good long time, too. And with
I'm in a country band, it doesn't work. But anyway.
Ooh.
Well, your brothers being in the military, I would be curious, and I'm not that I'm suggesting you do anything. I would be curious how they feel about this birther. Are you familiar with this guy? Major.
I saw it on one of the, I don't know if it was Truth Out or Brad Blog, or is that the guy with the racist, the Nazi?
No. This is Army Major Stefan Frederick Cook. Through the auspices of a lawyer who is an Obama conspiracy theorist by the name of Orly Tates, she, on his behalf, filed a lawsuit claiming that Barack Obama had no right to send to deploy him to Afghanistan because Barack Obama was not born in the United States. Okay? That's bad enough. Well, the follow-up to that is... yeah, I know. The follow-up to that is what went down last night, or by last night, by showtime I had it. It turned out the Army had said, okay, son, you don't have to go. And, of course, I think it was our News Ninja Susan who had said, the perfect remedy for this would be to say, you don't have to go to Iraq or Afghanistan. Here's your marching orders. We'll see you in a couple of years when you get back from Ice Station Zebra in Greenland. So it turns out that the Army says, well, this has nothing to do with the lawsuit that you filed. But you have and I guess it's an Army rule that you have a right. He had volunteered for deployment you got up until the day you have to leave to, I guess, unvolunteer. I never heard of such a thing in the military.
I neither.
So they said, well, you obviously unvolunteered, so you don't have to go. So what happens? The lawyer, Orly Tates, which frankly sounds like something that happens in a porno movie.
Mm-hmm.
yes, it does. It came out gloating. And when I read this today, Lee, I just thought, you know, if I was in Afghanistan or Iraq and I read this, I would be looking for this son of a bitch the minute that I got home.
Sure.
And I'm told that that's a National Guard thing. It has something to do with the IRR or the Reserves, National Guard. Thanks, John Fox. Orly Tates comes out gloating. And claims a win because of filing this lawsuit. And she says, can you imagine what are the... she's made a whole career out of filing lawsuits claiming that Barack Obama isn't the president because he wasn't born in the United States.
Yeah, I got an aunt that's... I just got off a phone call with her, and she's still on that kick.
And
she works for Homeland Security, by the way. It turned out she was a courier for the CIA.
Oh, I'm just feeling better all the time.
Yeah. It's like I said, being from the South and then having, you know, a family tradition of military service, you know, there's a lot of things to.
Oh, that's a river that runs deep.
Yeah.
So,
well, when you've got no unions, the military looks pretty good.
How true that is. How very true that is. So she goes out gloating, this Orly Tates woman. And she says, can you imagine what are the consequences? This is disastrous for the administration. We'll have no military because anytime any soldier, any sailor, any airman does not want to follow any orders, all he has to do is call an attorney and say, I don't want to follow this order because I question the legitimacy of the commander in chief.
I'm not sure how much interaction they've got between civilian attorneys and JAG anyway, though. You know what I mean? I don't know how many. And that bugged the hell out of me during the Sotomayor thing when they were hitting her up on what does she know about the UCMJ.
Oh, indeed. But this woman is gloating because she thinks she has just dealt a crippling blow to the United States military. What happened to support the troops and the yellow ribbons and all of that stuff, Lee?
Well, you know who gets rich off of the yellow ribbons, right?
The manufacturer in Taiwan and China?
Yeah, that would be the one. I don't even know what to say half the time. And like I said, you know, the stuff that I get off of, like I said, the Horn and Malloy and Rachel Maddow, although, you know, hers and Oberman's stuff is, I don't want to say watered down, but I mean, it's almost like it's a limited hangout.
Well, but it's got to be fit for television. And that puts a whole boatload of wildly different and varied circumspections on the whole process.
Right, but the thing is, the stuff that doesn't make it into that, there's so much that doesn't make it that is newsworthy, and that's what just drives me. And maybe that's what's so addictive to, you know, shows like yours and Mike's, or attractive, I guess would be a better word. But at the same time, like I said, since there's so much stuff that just gets thrown away, you know, because it doesn't have to do with Michael Jackson or whatever, you know, there's so much stuff out there, you know, and it's, you know, I forgive my language. I mean, it's just like, how many times a day can you say what the fuck? I mean, it's just, you know,
yeah.
What in the world? How many times? You know, so it's like I'm trying to drive here. So
careful.
But it's pretty astounding, you know. And there is just so much that's just not there. And so I really, really do appreciate what you guys do. As far as the kid taking the Greenland assignment, I would in a heartbeat. I don't think there's any depleted uranium over there.
Well, true. Just a depleted ice cap.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, but man didn't cause that. So, and probably Barack Obama wasn't born there, although he's not certain of that either.
Right.
Well, I appreciate the kind words, Lee, and let me offer some in your direction as well. We have a vast and varied audience of good, decent, liberal human beings, and they're all over the country. But I'm a Southern boy, like you. And I got to tell you that when I hear from folks in places like Texas or our buddies in Alabama or Tennessee, and this is not to diminish in any regard folks in other places, I get a little swell. I dare to hope a little bit, because I know that if you're willing to call and have a conversation on this show, that you're not going to shy away from a conversation at home.
No.
And that tells me that the tide can turn. And that tells me that with people like you and, you know, Texas Betsy's down there in Austin, horn psychotherapist Rick Goodner is not far from Austin, and all our buddies all across the South, as long as we're not quiet, they can't pretend we don't exist. And when they fail, when the conservatives and right-wingers and family values crowd fail again and again and again, and we're standing up and we are saying, we knew you would, because of your policies, because of how you are, then eventually people with a reasonable, rational mind have got to look up and say, what do they know that we don't know, and how did we get conned with this damned hoodoo for so long?
Well, that's a great question, by the way. How did we get conned? You know, in a bad, bad way, or a big, bad way. One of the things down here is, like, I think you've touched on it, I think I've mentioned it to you before as well. You know, I've lived in the same town as nutbag Alex Jones. And so there's some people. He's got his little minions all over this town, by the way. It sucks. They've got like something down here called the Alamo Draft House. It's a theater where you can go have a beer and watch a movie, get something to eat.
Oh, I love those.
I do too. They're nice, and they serve comfort food for all practical purposes. But you know, stuff that you usually wouldn't eat except at 2 a.m. or at the movies. But they've got you can't watch a movie without them. Without hearing his voice come on, something about turn your cell phones off or we'll find you, and you know, it's just crap. So, but some of his little clones, you can actually hit them with some of this other stuff, and you know, I think because they're pretty much willing to believe anything, that you can every once in a while get a shot into them. But for the most part, since it's so hardcore right wing down here. And by the way, I don't mean to digress too far, but these family value guys, every time one of these sex scandals comes up, it's just hysterical to me. They're usually people that we're talking about in churches or whatever anyway. And that was one of the reasons I got out of the Baptist church when they sat there and handed out the latest, I am going way off track, but it was the latest Bible study or whatever. We were going to all get together and read Chuck Colson's book. And I went, you know what?
Yeah, I'm taking a powder on this one. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm done. That, and I'm already really turned off on the $5 million basketball gym you guys are putting in.
Yeah, and the bowling alley. And you know, another late great one, Sam Kennison, when he said, you know, I just want to be there in heaven when Jesus looks at Jerry Falwell and says, where the did I tell you, did you see me telling you to build a water slide?
Yeah, yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I don't know if the disciples all got together and played 6-on-6. I don't know what book that was in. Probably in one of the Gnostic Gospels. You know, but
yeah.
So you know, these massive building projects. And oh, by the way, the Young Earthers. Here's the one that my mom drops on me, and they used to use it in the Baptist Church too. How do you come up with 6,000 years or whatever? Because a day, what is it? A day to God is 1,000 years to us, and 1,000 years, and a day to us is 1,000. I forget, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, and then there's the truth of what Bill Hicks said. There's a crowd out there that says we've added up all the ages of all the names in the Bible, and we came up with 6,000 years.
Right.
Help me, God. You know.
Yeah, I like it. I'm glad I'm strapped in.
Yeah, because I think. Yeah, exactly. And Lee, I got to tell you before we roll. You mentioned being a musician, and so, you know, with a love of music, and you mentioned your military background and those of your brothers. I don't know, this album came out probably toward the first of the year, but I don't know if you've heard Jason Isbell and the 400 Unit. That's just the name of the album. Jason Isbell, Isbell, good Southern boy, and the 400 Unit. There are some lyrics on that album that for anybody with... who has been touched by the military will I think it'll blow you away if you can get your hands on it.
Oh, excellent. And one technical problem
I need to
mention, and like I said, maybe eventually I'll get it figured out. I've tried to sign up and get into the chat room, but haven't had the email to verify to get in thing ever show up. So.
Well, I think that can be remedied. Shoot me a note and remind me, and I will make sure that happens.
All right, thanks, Bob.
Because I think you'll have a blast in there.
I appreciate it. Thanks again for what you're doing.
Oh, thank you, Lee. Great conversation. You take care now.
Peace.
Bye. From Austin, our new friend, Lee. God, I love having new friends. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Fancy.
Hey, Fancy. How are you, dear?
Hey, I went to school in Austin, so hi to Lee. And I loved Austin a long time ago. And Kinky can't be mayor of Austin because he lives in Kerrville.
He's outside the city limits.
Just bringing that up about Kinky. If you don't know about Kinky Freeman, he's a neat character.
He is. I love his books.
Do you know about Kinky and the Texas Jew Boys?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
He's written some very... I heard a piece, somebody playing Amelia Earhart the other day.
That was Malloy, I think, because I heard it too.
No, it was on. It was out of Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
But Amelia Earhart, Queen of the Air, and Kinky's quite an interesting character. Now his parents ran a camp down there, Echo Hill.
Right.
And it's been divided now, and I think his brother and sister-in-law still have this camp. But on Kinky's part of it, they have a wonderful program, and it's for dogs and cats.
Right.
Rehabilitation, and they get these animals healthy again, and they've got a grooming expert to get them attractive, and they have charm school to make them pleasant to be with, and they have them, they help to get some pretty rotten mutts adopted. Which I just think is doing God's work. I think that's a very nice...
Well, it very definitely is, and I don't think Lee was working in that direction so much as, you know, just begging, because Kinky's got some good ideas. You know, get in there and don't be a joke candidate. Be real.
Yeah, Kinky does take votes away from if there were a real candidate, and I've had friends work on his campaigns before because he's an amazing character. And, yeah, he graduated with honors, University of Texas, and then went into the Peace Corps and went to Borneo. And he laughingly says, we were here to teach them to do agriculture on land they've been doing agriculture on for 5,000 years.
Yeah, but they needed some chemicals is what they needed.
Yeah, a psychologist from the University of Texas, yes, ma'am.
And
also, just
Go ahead.
Another point where he was saying that and I forget the name of the town, that tragic shooting, and you played the 20 minutes of that awful tape of the mother holding them off with a pistol and talking with the police. And the reason the police took 20 minutes to get there is it is in the middle of nowhere. It's down off of I-19 between Tucson and Mexico in the desert. It's a wide place in the road. They needed Pima County Sheriff's Office, but it's a big county and not that many people from the Sheriff's Office.
And probably not that many detachments either.
No. You know, getting them there in 30 minutes was...
Well, see, there's a disconnect, Fancy, between us folks back east and folks out west. When we hear the word county, it's something you can drive across at best in an hour. Okay.
Okay. I'm actually looking at Wikipedia right now in Pima County, where I'm sitting, and where this event happened. Is 843,746. Oh, no, that's the population. That's the population. Let me get them. Come on, Wikipedia, tell me how big we are. Population. Well.
But, you know, interestingly, I had the point driven home for me today because I sat in sort of rapt horror watching another one of the C-SPAN channels. I went over to watch what they were doing in the house, and it apparently was this kabuki theater that involved Arizona Congressman Jeff Flake.
Oh, yes.
Earning his name.
Yes.
Who kept adding, and it was all procedural, and he kept griping about green job incubator initiatives in the appropriations bill. And he would get up and do a 5-minute speech on every bill to which he objected. And at one point he said, you know, y'all got little counties over in the east, but out here we've only got a few counties in Arizona, and they big.
We got 14 counties.
Yeah.
And some of them are actually quite large.
Yeah, right, whereas West Virginia has 57.
Okay, Jeff Flake, there's a town in Arizona called Snowflake. And the reason it's called Snowflake is because there were two families there, the Snows and the Flakes.
Oh, my God.
Okay, and that's how it got its name. And you know who hails from Snowflake?
Oh, Jeff Flake.
Well, the lovely Mrs. Allen. Remember Mrs. Allen who told us that the Earth's been here 6,000 years?
Her, too. I don't care. If I'm dying of thirst in Arizona, I ain't drinking the water there. You can't make me.
I think you have to be born there. But they're not all that welcoming to out-of-towners.
Yeah, you ain't from around here, are you, boy? Yeah, I know.
I can't remember her first name, but we...
Barbara, wasn't it? No, that's an old ballad.
No, I sent you something on her.
Yeah, and right, because...
I'm your favorite pen pals.
Right, because and she's the young earther who wants to mine uranium in Arizona for the senior citizens.
But yeah, that she and Jeff Flake are from from the same place out there. In fact, Tucson is sort of like Austin. Austin was the liberal pimple on the butt of a conservative Texas, and Pima County is where Tucson is about the same for Arizona. And we maintain a pretty open and liberal
land area, 2,000 square miles, Pima County.
And we have two Indian reservations in the county, one of which extends over the border into Mexico. I mean, the people. So it's an interesting place. I wanted to make another observation here about Rush Limbaugh. And I remember, God, I'm thinking like 10 years ago, but Frontline did a piece on, did an hour piece on Limbaugh. And one of the things that became very obvious as they're doing this is that here is this man who is perfectly capable of standing up in front of a group of people and lecturing. Put him behind a podium, put him at the speaker's table, he's fine. When he was man-to-man in a social situation, he's totally incapable. If he were just sitting at a round table with a bunch of other people, there's no... He's only capable of sitting at the head of the table.
Right.
And he had no skills at all for just interaction.
Right. Emotionally and socially stunted.
Yeah. Yeah. He can tell you what to do, but he can talk to you, but he can't talk with you.
Yeah, or at you he can talk.
Yeah. Yeah, he can talk to you. But he can't talk with you.
Oh, and your pals in the chat room are Sylvia Allen.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. Yes. The memory is the second thing to go, and I don't remember what the first is. But I'm having serious memory glitches, and I was one of those people with a really good memory. Okay, so... I'm thinking of a book. I can't remember the name of the book. I cannot remember the author. But again, about 10 years ago, there was a really nice book out there about what language means to different people. And basically what the author was saying is that when the Republicans use this word, they mean one thing. And when the Democrats use this word, they mean something else. But one of the things he pointed out, and he said, you've got basically two kinds of family structures. And one family structure is a strong father. He sits at the head of the table. And this family always has Thanksgiving dinner at 1 o'clock on Thanksgiving Day. Not 5 minutes to one, not 5 minutes after one. They always have exactly the same thing. They always have this kind of dressing and not that kind of dressing. And, you know, very, very rigid about how it's done. And the other kind of family says, you know, find a seat. I think, how do you guys feel about fish for Thanksgiving this year? It's been a long time since we really, did a nice fish. And, God, that's my family.
The second one.
There are people who need the authoritarian. These are the rules, and we do not deviate. And those who do deviate have some kind of moral, well, we have a moral disgust with them. People who use, you know. Clam chowder dressing on me, you know.
Right.
There's kind of a moral.
There will be chestnuts in the dressing, and there will not be any seafood.
Right.
Absolutely. And I think this is where we are. This is how since I read that book, it's always how I kind of look at people and I think, how do you have Thanksgiving? What's Thanksgiving like in your house?
Well, you know, we do some of that because it's a way of honoring the past. I mean, I make my mother's cornbread dressing recipe because it's my mother's cornbread dressing recipe, and it was her mother's and her mother's before her.
It's also a very pleasant thing.
Oh, yeah. Every Thanksgiving, my family looks at me and says, why don't you do this more often? And I said, because then it wouldn't be special now. So I'm a little bit guilty of some of that. But I've got around these parts. I've got a buddy who says describes that as being rule oriented. Yeah. Don't even try to talk to them. Don't even try to talk to them. You can't talk to them. They're rule oriented and they ain't gonna budge.
Yeah. Well, there was a wonderful story and I heard years ago and a woman made pot roast the way her mother did. And the first thing she did was remove the bone and then work on the pot roast. And so she went to her mother at one point and she said, how did you learn to make pot roast this way? And he said, well, my mother told me, you know, you take the bone and then you do this and you do this. So her grandmother was living and she went to her grandmother and she said, how did you learn to do pot roast this way? And she said, well, she said, when I was first married, I didn't have a pot big enough to accommodate the full roast and the bone. So I removed the bone and then, you know, had to cut the pot roast up. Now, this family had gone through years of bigger pots, but they kept the process of removing the bone. And I think we fall into a lot of that something that's done for expediency or to meet the period, the situation of the time, becomes codified into law.
And the next thing you know, it's religion.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you can find that all over Christianity. You can find it in Islam. You can find it in Judaism. You can find it, and you can most assuredly, as you note, you can find it in the government. And in you know, whenever somebody's
I had a plastic bottle in my laundry in my dishpan today to take the label off to put it in recycling, and it was for laundry. For a dishwashing product. And I'm pulling it off, and I realize it has the U in the circle, the kosher hashra notation. And I'm thinking, who eats laundry detergent? I mean, who eats
right.
washing?
But it does go deeper than that, because it has to do with how you can clean and what you clean and
oh yeah, in a formal home, the dishes are
yeah,
and the. In a very, very observant home.
Yeah, Texas Betsy has been kind enough to school me on that, and it's absolutely fascinating. And interestingly, it's traditions like that allowed, for instance, Jewish populations during the Black Death, as it went over Europe, to survive, because they had traditions of cleanliness, when the rest of Western Europe. Was you know more than happy to you know hey let me put my hand in the dog's mouth and then I'll eat with my fingers.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah right exactly. Wonderful conversation, Fancy, but I got to roll. We're out of time.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Wishing all well.
Oh, and you as well. We'll talk soon, I hope.
Bye bye now.
Bye now. Out on the desert in Arizona, that's our pal Fancy, and that's the end. Wow, what a wonderful show you guys made. It's about a minute before the hour, so quick thank yous to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, to Ben Birch, to all of you who helped keep this all going. We'll get the particulars set up so that you can get your own copy of Diane's beautiful, beautiful print. Thank you to Coal River Mountain Watch, who also helps keep us going. They are indeed the bravest, hardest working people I know. When you see what's going on here in West Virginia, you understand why I say that. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Six, five, four, three, two, one.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy Gene Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Guy James Show, coming to you from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida, Naples, Fort Myers area, and all around the world via the Internet. Thank you for joining us this afternoon on this Thursday, the 28th of May. My, we're getting down to the end of the month again. Seems like those, the older you get, the quicker those ends of the months happen to come along, and they're certainly going fast nowadays. Anyway, hope everything's fine where you are today. It's another hot, humid day here. I'm most likely around 90 degrees and lots of humidity today, so we'll be, but we're inside the studio, cool as a cucumber, with the official Guy James Show puppies, Kukla and Sophie, on duty, watching the door, making sure no right-wingers come in here and get us. And believe me, they do watch the door, so beware, any of you right-wingers. I don't think an ant could get past them without them letting somebody know. Oh my, yes, they go crazy. This is my house, my studio, wherever they happen to be. This place is mine, and don't you even think about coming in. Well, enough about the puppies this afternoon. We got a great guest coming up for you later this afternoon around 3:30. Actually, a relative of mine you've heard me talk about, my cousin Mary Ellen Withrow, former treasurer of the United States, is going to be with us to tell us about a little bit about what's going on in Washington right now. She still lives there. And what it's like to be treasurer of the United States and a little bit of what's under the purview of the treasurer of the United States. It changes from one administration to another. And when she had it, it was a great big job, and now it's not so much. So it does go back and forth. So we'll have her along with us. The treasurer of the United States is the one who signs your money over there on the left-hand side. You got the secretary of the treasury on the right-hand side, and she was fortunate enough to serve with Lloyd Benson. And then over on the left side, the treasurer of the United States. We'll talk about that with her coming up around 3:30 this afternoon. What else have we got going on today? I don't know how you feel about it, but I've got ambivalent feelings about these deal of these torture photos. You know what I mean? On the one hand, I really hate to see guilty people go unpunished, especially if these orders did come down from on high, as it appears they did. So I am just wondering, should they be released, and should we get to the bottom of this matter, and should we find out if Dick Cheney, the former vice president of the United States, had anything to do with this, and if he did, shouldn't he be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law? Don't know why he would be any different than anyone else, although, you know, wealth and privilege does have its advantages. But if he were guilty of passing down orders like that, then we'd have this big argument with all the conservatives. Well, it really isn't torture. Well, I think we've had one right-winger already change his mind about that. Old man cow from Chicago who gave up after, 5 seconds? And then we've got Hannity, who's all mouth and no ass, who, originally, I'm a tough guy, and I'll be waterboarded, I'll do it. Hasn't been any mention of it since, has there, Sean? Big guy. Big tough guy. Big Sean. Roughy, toughy, brave. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He likes to hang out with people like that. He likes to name drop people like Colonel Ollie North and some of the people he goes around with. But quite frankly, himself, he is a coward. He said he'd be waterboarded. He said it wasn't torture. And if it's not torture, if I didn't think it was torture, I'd do it. But I believed it is. All along, I believed it's torture. And so I don't want anything to do with it. But if you're going to be a weenie like Sean Hannity and stand up and say, well, I don't think it's so bad. And also, Rush Limbaugh, although he never volunteered to do it, he's opened his mouth all along and said, well, it's not torture. It's not torture. It's nothing more than a fraternity prank. Mm-hmm. Well, all you guys that think that, let's go for it. Let's go for it. Let's line them all up and see which one of them thinks, you know, how they feel about it afterwards, like Mancow. I completely admire the man for coming forth and telling it like it is. And Hannity has the nerve, after finking out on his pledge to do it himself, has the nerve to call him up and say, well, it is torture, after Mancow had already said it was. It was. I'll tell you, these guys, they're afraid of an honest debate. You know, and I've told you this sometimes on specific instances. Over and over again, I've contacted Mark Levin, Sean Hannity, who else? Glenn Beck, Limbaugh, Mike Gallagher, O'Reilly, and a few others. And I've invited them to come on my show and debate me. Now, you may think that's funny. Well, why would they do that? Well, I've heard back from some of their producers, and their answers have been pretty much so. What if some of you are thinking, well, why would we want to do that? And my answer always is, well, so you can try and take down a bona fide liberal in a fair fight. It's not going to happen. I take any of them on in a fair fight. Bob would as well. This I know. But it's not going to happen. The closest I ever got to accomplishing that goal of taking down a notable conservative on this program was a few years ago when, what's his name? Grover Norquist, the Republican tax guru. That's all he knows how to say is cut taxes. He agreed to do the show. And he canceled on the day of the show. And his representative did call me. And he said, just what the hell are you trying to pull here? We didn't know you were a goddamn liberal. Really, that's what he said. So these guys don't want to go on a show where there's a fair fight going to happen. You notice that Limbaugh will call in to somebody. He will never give up control. And I would be more than willing to have a debate with any of these guys, anytime, anywhere. Give up control on my end and have them give up control on their end. You know, let the dust settle where it would. I think I know what would happen. But, you know, getting back to this torture.